The following Dharma talk was presented at Common Ground Meditation Center, Minneapolis, Minnesota, as part of the monthly Guest Dharma series.
I came to meditation originally through the academic study of Buddhism. So I was studying the Buddhist tradition in graduate school, and I would frequently read the text that in some form or another would say, but to really understand what we're saying, you have to sit. You know, you have to meditate. And I'd say, you know, fascinating. So to understand this really, you have to sit. How many times can you read that before you say, you know, I think I should sit. I should probably try to sit. And so I ended up first studying with someone who comes out of a Southeast Asian Theravada tradition and taught a Vipassana practice, Gil Fronsdal. Some of you may have read his work. He was my first teacher. And then I became involved in a Soto Zen community called Kanando with someone who had studied with Shinryu Suzuki Roshi by the name of Les Kay. And I was with that community for the years that I was in California. And so I had the practice and I had my academic work. And while I've kept them separate, I also have come to realize that the two can benefit each other. This is one of the things that I will be coming back to at the end of the talk. It's actually related. Sitting, I think, has helped deepen my understanding of what it is that I'm reading and studying. And then studying these traditions academically has helped me see my practice in a larger context and to understand why it transforms people in the way that it does. So I hope that today's talk, even though it's focusing on Chinese traditions, East Asian traditions, can also help shed light on the Buddhist practice that we have here. So one of the things I'm going to focus on is death. And I think that reflecting on death, it's an ideal topic to approach from a comparative perspective. On the one hand, it is truly a human universal. I mean, all people from all cultures must somehow cope with death. And so it provides a way of making cross-cultural and trans-historical connections. I mean, a cursory glance around the world reveals so many similarities. Like, you know, death rituals, for example, are universal. But at the same time, there are few areas in which the differences in human conceptions and practice loom so large. The notions of what death is, the afterlife, the appropriate treatment of the corpse, the proper attitude towards death, these vary widely within and among cultures. And so they can highlight distinctive features of various systems of thought, and some can pose a radical challenge to our own dearly held beliefs and views. So within the Buddhist tradition, for example, you know, we have a general belief in rebirth from the early sutras. But this isn't unique to Buddhism. I mean, it grew out of a larger context in India, and even today, people from many traditions within India, Hinduism, Jainism, the Sikh tradition, and the Buddhist tradition, all believe in rebirth. Now, some forms of Buddhism focus on rebirth in a very analytic way. Tibetan Buddhism, for example. You know, really close attention to the process of death and what happens in the in-between states and the process of rebirth. Other forms of Buddhism, not so much. And I think in the Theravada tradition, in Vipassana practice, like in Zen, there really isn't as much emphasis on rebirth. In fact, there's a really interesting article written about Ajahn Chah, the great teacher Ajahn Chah, who was working with people who were dying. And in the entire time he was working with these people, I would read through all of his dialogues with them and all of his discussions, and I never once saw him refer to rebirth. It was all about mindful dying, conscious dying, right? The lessons I have told you all along about impermanence and letting go, now the ultimate teacher has come, right? So be aware at each step of this process of what is happening to you. So that's the kind of approach to dying that you tend to find more, I think, in Theravada and Zen than rebirth. So the thinkers I'm looking at today, and these are classical Confucian and Taoist thinkers from China. And so they were in about the 5th, 6th century BCE through the 3rd, 2nd century BCE. So that few hundred years of what's called the classical period. One of the interesting things about them is they never talk about an afterlife. they don't talk about, you know, what happens after we die, and they don't think abstractly about the meaning of death, about the origins of death, and all of that. They really focus on this world. But they talk about death and dying all the time, only in terms of how we actually experience it. And we experience it in three ways. One, our thoughts, right? What we think about death. Some of us more than others. I tend to be one of these people who think a lot about death. That my course on death and dying, in a way, is the way I turned my obsession into a class. The other two ways are how we experience death. And these are how we ourselves die, and the one that we experience most often, coming to terms with the death of others, the loss of others. So these texts have a lot about that, how we should think about death, how we die, and how we deal with the death of others, but not about anything speculative, like what happens after we die. So to me, it's really interesting to see, how is it that people from these traditions deal with finding meaning and purpose and solace without any notion of immortality, without any notion of an afterlife? Because in virtually every other religion in the world, there's something about surviving death, but not in the early Confucian and Taoist texts. So as somebody who tends to be fairly skeptical about the prospects of surviving death myself, I don't really believe in personal immortality, this is of great personal interest to me as well. How do they do this? And so that's what I'm going to talk about today. So now we can sort of follow along on the outline there and on the passages. I'll be referring to these passages. So that was my little introduction. The first thing I want to mention, and I'll go fairly quickly through this part, so please, again, stop me if you'd like any more depth on this. One thing you immediately see that distinguishes the Confucians from the Taoists, and Zhuangzi, the Confucian figure I'm going to emphasize most here is Confucius himself. And the Taoist figure that I'm choosing is Zhuangzi, who, some of you may have read the Tao Te Ching, it's one of the most popular of the Taoist texts. But if you haven't read Zhuangzi, I highly recommend him. There is no voice quite like his in the world of religious thought. He's highly distinctive. His text is filled with riddles and parables and paradoxes and poetry. He's a sometimes maddeningly slippery figure to pin down, but he's fun to deal with. And in fact, just a quick side note, what we call Zen Buddhism, or Chan in China, is part Buddhism from India, of course, but I think almost equal part Zhuangzi. So if you ever read Zen Buddhism and you say to yourself, that sounds nothing like the early Buddhist sutras, that sounds like, you know, these crazy Zen masters, where does that all come from? Zhuangzi. So that's the Taoist figure that I'm talking about here. When we look at the Analects of Confucius, the texts of Confucius, we'll notice a very strong emphasis on grief, on mourning, and on death rituals. He talks about these things all the time. You know, how to properly mourn those we love, particularly family members and parents in particular. At one point he says, humans come close to realizing themselves to the fullest extent when they're mourning for their parents, which is a very powerful statement. And you can see in these two passages I have here, Confucius tends to be somebody who emphasizes simplicity and frugality in his actions. And yet here he says that in mourning, it's better to err on the side of grief, on expressing grief. To the Confucians, grief at the loss of a loved one is a natural and fully human response. And what we should do with that, and there's a Confucian thinker named Xunzi who comes later, he said grief is also one of the most potentially harmful of all of these feelings and experiences we have. It could be debilitating. And if we do not express it properly, it can come up in unexpected and harmful ways. So for Confucians, the way that we deal with this grief is through ritual. Ritual allows for the expression in a harmonious and beautiful way. So there's these really, in Xunzi's work, beautiful descriptions of death rituals and how we use symbols to come to terms with these very ambivalent and complex feelings that arise. And we can talk more about that. I can give you some examples. Just one. I'll just give you one now because it's so fascinating. Xunzi talks about, he's a disciple of Confucius, that when a loved one dies, you should take an object that meant a lot to that person and place it with them in the grave. But before you do, break it. The reason he says this is, first of all, that you recognize that this is something that meant something to them, and we recognize what they meant to us by honoring that, right? Like if someone played the guitar, right? This is part of who they are. But you force yourself to sever. It's called a tie-breaking ritual. That connection that you had by saying, they're not going to be playing this guitar up in the heavens or anything. I have to acknowledge that, right? This is done. This will not be played again. And by physically making yourself do this, you break this dissonance in your mind that they still feel alive. You know, I know they're dead, but they still feel alive. And physically, you make yourself break that. So the Confucians talk a lot about this, how to grieve, how to mourn, how to do this ritually. And in passage number 2, you know, one of his beloved disciples dies, and he says, you know, if not for him, for whom should I show undue sorrow? I'm overwhelmed. So the emphasis on grief and mourning. Another thing, then we can contrast this. All right, so we look at Zhuangzi now. And Zhuangzi constantly talks about death as if it were just one more transformation in life. No reason to get upset. Just accept these ongoing transformations. So this Master Yu who falls ill and he seems calm at heart. Oh, that which creates is making me all crickety like this. Do you resent it? Why, no. What would I resent? I received life because time had come, and I'll lose it because the order of things passes on. Be content with this time and dwell in this order, and then neither sorrow nor joy can touch you. And then we see it again here. Master Lai grows ill, and he's at the point of death. His wife and children gather around and begin to cry. Now, from a Confucian perspective, nothing could be more natural. Never interfere with that if someone is crying over someone's death. That's a universal human experience. But in Zhuangzi's texts, Master Li goes up to them and says, "Shu, get back. Don't disturb the process of change." Right? And then finally, Zhuangzi's, the death of his own wife is described in passage 5. And he's violating Confucian ritual in such a profound way. I mean, this should be a somber time, and he's sitting there and beating on a drum and singing. And his friend comes in and says, you know, isn't that going too far even for you? And then he says, look, there have been this series of transformations. Her spirit forms, her body forms, and then another change and she's dead. It's just like the four seasons. She's going to lie down peacefully now, and if I were to follow after her bawling and sobbing, it would show I don't understand anything about fate. So we seem to have two really different conceptions from the start. One that recognizes grief and mourning, the importance of that, right? Just showing it through crying, and the other who says we need to just let things go, accept the change, not hold on, not mourn or grieve. So here's just one more illustration of the difference. Confucians lament premature death. One of the worst things, the most tragic things that can happen is for a young person who's on the path, right, on the way and becoming a good, cultivated human being to die young. And that's what happens to his disciple Yan Yuan. And he says, I watched him making progress, but I did not see him realize his capacity to the full. What a pity. No, he's really sad. Now, Zhuangzi, for the sage, the end is as good as the beginning. An early death is as good as reaching old age. There's actually no such thing as premature death. One change comes to another. There's life, there's death. What's early, what's late? It happens when it happens. So we also see a significant difference there. So I can go on. There's a lot of other differences, but I'm just sort of laying those out to start because now we really are going to get into what's behind all the differences. I would argue that what explains the difference is that the Confucians and the Taoists have a different conception of the self. what a self is, underlying these conceptions of death. And that further, these different conceptions of self rest on two key concepts: differing understandings of temporality, so how time works, right? How we exist through time, and nature. So basically, that's what I'm going to be working with here, is self, temporality, and nature, and how those three things lead to these two very different views of death. So now we're on the second page of the passages here. When we look at the Confucians, and now I'm going to, towards the end of this talk, I want to ask if you reflect on Buddhist practice and also on your own experience in life to think about these different conceptions of temporality and selfhood and see what you think about them. For Confucians, human life can be seen as an unfolding narrative. There are stages in our lives that are marked by rituals, again, the significance of rituals, and we have roles and duties and virtues appropriate to those different stages of our lives. So, you know, passage 8 is his own conception of his narrative. Like, here's how I developed over my life, starting at the age of 15 and then developing himself more and more until at 70, he could just follow his heart, but it would never lead him astray, right? When you're fully cultivated, you don't have to force yourself to do the right thing. You already have internalized it, and it's natural. It's a narrative of development. It's a narrative of cultivation. One of the reasons this happens is our body mind, our bodies and minds, themselves change over time. So we're always working with this changing thing. And you can see in passage 9 that he thinks about it in terms of our chi. Our chi is sort of like our breath, life energy that comes through us. And so sometimes our chi is strong and vibrant, and sometimes we know it's weaker, or, you know, there's the chi changes. And he says, look, at different ages, you have different kinds of chi. And therefore, you have to guard against different kinds of deformations. You know, the young people's chi, it's all whipped up, you know, constantly filled with desire. You know, when we're in the prime of our life, we have to guard against our chi becoming too unyielding and stubborn and bellicose. And then in old age, we have to guard against hoarding and acquisitiveness. And so you always have something to work on. It's developmental and it's narrative. Now, Zhuangzi, on the other hand, sees life as a ceaseless flow of moments, a continuous transformation. He doesn't speak in terms of some sort of stage-by-stage orderly development. And in fact, one of the concepts he talks most about, he calls it free and easy wandering, or wandering without a destination. He says, everybody in life, you have a path that you're on and you have a goal, right? I'm moving towards this. That's that narrative concept. Well, at this age, I'm going to do that, and then later I'll get the degree and I'll do that, and then that's a very Confucian way of thinking. Zhuangzi says, just wander. You don't need a goal. You don't need a path. And another notion he has is called wu wei, which means effortless action. To simply be guided by where your nature takes you this moment or where your nature moves you the next. It's kind of a little bit more like, say, non-human animals live. You know, they don't sit there and plan, you know, wonder what I'm going to do next week. Hungry, I eat. When it's time to play, I play. When I want to, I mean, that is, you know, we can learn a lot from animals. This text is filled with animals for this reason. So you can see in passages 10 and 11, it's all about change. It's all about the alternation of things, the impermanence of things. He calls it a headlong dash. Everything will change of itself. Day and night, things change place before us. And then you can see sort of this idea of wandering where there is no trail. He has one other temporality at work. And this is what I call sort of the natural cycles temporality. Because yes, things are always changing. But at the same time, there are patterns in the change. Natural patterns. See, he talked about the seasons before. There's an example. So we see the natural cycles model, right? That, you know, things wax and wane. Things revolve in their course. Things have transformations and evolutions, endings and beginnings. So now we can see these different types of temporalities at work. A narrative temporality, a momentary, moment-by-moment temporality, and then a natural cycles kind of temporality.
So now we're going to move to the next.
Oh, please. Okay, so there's the Confucians, and they have the narrative temporality, right? Our lives have stages, they progress in a developmental way. Then Zhuangzi, it has this moment by moment. All you experience are these moments, and that's all we have. Everything changes. And then an emphasis also on nature and natural patterns and natural cycles. So I just call these narrative, momentary, and natural cycles, temporalities. Now we're going to get to the part about self and how it's connected with that. The word self for a Confucian is an achievement. We may be born Homo sapiens, we're biological humans, but we achieve selfhood. Selfhood is an achievement over time. My argument here is that the notion of selfhood requires narrative temporality. In the words of philosopher Charles Taylor, we must inescapably understand our lives in narrative form. So when you think about talking about who you are to someone, when they ask you, it's usually you tell them a story. And the story has stages, right? Oh, yeah, when I was young, I did this, and then at this point, I did that. And then, so you're telling your narrative, and you can revise it. It's interesting when you go back, you see things in a new way. There's different significance to the narrative. But nevertheless, who you are comes out of that story and out of that narrative. We work on ourselves over time. Now, I'm going to throw in one more concept to that, which is nature, because I mentioned nature would be a part of it. The story for the Confucians of what happens over time is a story of what we're doing with the nature we're born with. And there's two major Confucian figures. I didn't put them on here. Don't worry about the names. But Mencius is one and Shenzi is the other. And they differ on what our nature is like. So for Mencius, our nature is good. It's pure. We're oriented towards goodness naturally. And for Shunzi, we're basically selfish, greedy people, right? So they both tell these narrative stories, the development stories, but the stories are different. For Mencius, the story is nurturing, cultivating, strengthening your nature. All of his metaphors are agricultural. He says they're like little sprouts, this goodness within you. Water them, care for them, tend them, and over time you'll become a good person. So the only reason people ever become bad is because either the environment they're in is really bad, so the sprouts wither and die, or they neglect them. But if you care for them and nurture them and tend them, you'll become a good person. So that's to him what self-cultivation is, nurturing your nature. The other guy, Shunzi, the entire story is trying to reshape, reform, and craft that selfish, greedy nature until you're a decent human being. His metaphors are all about craftsmanship, pounding and sawing and right making that nature good, because otherwise, if you just follow your nature, you'll be insufferable. So those are the two stories. And we can get back to that if you want afterwards. But I just am illustrating the point that the Confucians may differ within themselves, but their main point is we all work with our nature, with what we're given, and we all somehow cultivate and craft it into something good over time. That's the narrative. So for Mencius, self is the realization of nature, and for Shunzi, self is the overcoming of nature. All right, now, back to Zhuangzi. It'll all come together, I promise. We go back to Zhuangzi. Zhuangzi doesn't have narrative. And if I say that selfhood depends on narrative, what does that mean for Zhuangzi? No self. We know that there's a no-self doctrine in Buddhism, so that's one of the interesting things, and it's why when Buddhism comes to China, so many people look at Buddhism through a Zhuangzi and Taoist lens, because he also had a similar concept. Not identical, but it certainly shares a lot. So if we look at passages 15 through 18 on the sheet, in passage 15 he actually says, "The perfect man has no self." And then he talks about, if you look at passage 17, I mean, really, this could be from a Buddhist passage, number 17. We go around telling each other, I do this, I do that. But how do we know that this I we talk about has any I to it? You know, it's just something we say, but how do we know there's something actually there, some substantive thing that's there? So then the question is, how do we realize this no-self? Because for him, all those categories that society gives you that you use to label yourself, your job, your status, your role, your everything, that's all up in the head. That's where it is. It lives up here. And if we could let go of that, if we can get rid of that, we would have our so-called self, this thing we've constructed, it's just a mental construction, would be gone. So how does he suggest we do it? Because it's pretty hard. He gives two main techniques. The first are techniques that you use that look very much like meditation. He doesn't go into as much detail as the Buddhist texts do. Those are very instructional. But it's quite evocative. He has two names for meditation. One of them is called sitting in forgetfulness. Right? Take all that stuff in the head and forget it. Just forget it. The other thing he calls it is the fasting of the mind. So these are his two practices. His second technique, and this one's really interesting, and we could talk more about this afterwards, is to become completely absorbed in what you're doing. To enter what he calls the flow state, and it's a form of skillful activity. So an example is if you're ever completely absorbed, if you're playing, say, a musical instrument, or you're involved in athletic activity, or even if you're reading a book, and time just goes, and suddenly you look at your watch and you're saying to yourself, wow, I mean, I've been doing this for an hour, and I had no idea. The question was, where were you for that hour? Like, in terms of that hour, there wasn't a you reading a book or you playing the piano. There was just the playing. There was just the reading. There was no separation. You literally melted into the activity, merged with that activity. So he talks a lot about that skillful activity. And then the real radical question is, I mean, if that flow state is a really heightened state of being and something where we realize ourselves fully in a way, can we live it like all the time? What would it be like to be in that state all the time? And that's what his sages are suggesting. So if you look at some of these, like 18 talks about a swimmer. He talks about growing up with his nature, and he goes along, he follows along with the water and never thinks of himself, never thinking about myself. So one of the questions then that will arise is for Zhuangzi, if self isn't what guides us, right? If we get self out of the way, what guides us? What leads us to do one thing rather than another, make decisions? And for him, it's nature. So self and nature are conflicting for him. And so just to bring together a few of the things I've talked about here, as the self relies on cultivation over time, and then on this narrative conception, no self is based on kind of this momentary nature, moment-to-moment existence, and this idea of continuous change. So for the Confucians, whereas self can be the realization of nature, for Zhuangzi, we try to manifest nature by forgetting self. When you forget self, your nature can emerge. But if you, he has this really great metaphor, I'll just mention it really quickly. He calls it the pipes of heaven. The metaphor works like this. You know what? How a pan pipe looks with all the different little pipes, right? And you go play it like that. He says, each of us is like a pipe. We all are born with a nature that makes us have a particular tone. Some of us are higher pitched, some of us are lower pitched. But the only way we ever will sound like ourselves, like our nature, is if we clear out the pipe. If it's stuffed full of stuff, things in our heads, we're never going to sound like who we truly are, like what our nature is. And what blows through the pipe? The Tao, nature itself. We are all just manifestations of nature. So we clear it out, and then here's the last thing he says, which is beautiful. And what happens when all of us can do it? If all of us clear it out, and all of us sound like our natures, and all of us produce this beautiful sound? Harmony. Not unison, because we're all different, but not discord, The Tao harmonizes, but we have to let it. And the biggest mistake we make is meddling with it. And the things in our head get in the way. So that's where he differs from the Confucians. So now, to sort of go along with the outline, we're on number 7. So we're coming towards the finale here. And then we'll have Q&A time. So how does this all come into death? I had to come back to that one. All of these thinkers, the Confucians and the Taoists, believe that the way we live well in the face of finitude and mortality is by cultivating connectedness, right? There's a form of connection and harmony and continuity. And they have different understandings of what types of connections there are and how we get there. So for the Confucians, the connections we make are primarily with others in society, through our social lives, through our family, participating in our community and politics and all of that. And you do it through the self you've developed over time. In other words, relationships are selves with each other, self to self. For Zhuangzi, the connection is with nature itself. We feel ourselves at home in, harmonized with nature. So for Zhuangzi, the connection is nature to nature. And for the Confucians, it is self to self. So, very quickly, I want to go through this part briefly. Oh, please go ahead.
One of the things I'm picking up from your experience is that I'm sensing that for us individually, from my perspective, I'm here looking for perspective on my own innate sense about how to live and all my process towards the end. And I'm hearing that the arbiter here of whether you're on that path, a healthy path, is your own innate feeling. In other words, all the mental constructs, all the signs and all that, from a modern perspective, obviously the writers couldn't write about that, but they can apply towards it. That's kind of, they're kind of meaningless in this picture. I mean, they may give us perspective, but both of them are really talking about your own relationship in different ways with the greater whole. They're not looking for any sort of intellectual edge on this. Is my perspective close, or do you agree with that? Or?
You had something on that, Rich?
Yes.
Good, please.
This is a summary of what I get out of my life. Confucius, connection with these comments. If I may read it.
Please.
If there is a righteousness in the house, there will be beauty in the character. If there is beauty in the character, there will be harmony in the home. If there will be harmony in the home, there will be order in the nation. The last one is that if there is order in the nation, there will be peace in the world. So that's what I get out of his teaching.
There's a beautiful text. It's called The Great Learning. And in this text, the Confucian text, it's perfect, given what you're saying. It's like this nested series of relationships that starts with an individual, you, and then family, and then community, and then nation, and then world, and then all under heaven, right? So you do the self-cultivation, but you do it in relationship with others. It's all about relationships in the end. I mean, it's about the people that you love, the people you learn from, your ancestors, your progeny. There's a story beyond yourself. You're part of this larger stream. So that's where you feel the meaning. I mean, one way that I think about this, and actually it's right in the next section here, when we get to these, we can go to it right now, in fact, modes of connection. I mean, that's what they're talking about. It's connectedness. What are you connected with? And when we talk about the big question, right? We talk about the meaning of life. What is the meaning of life, right? I think about how Confucians and Taoists would answer that differently. If you ask a Confucian what's the meaning of life, I would imagine people would say, if you're looking for some kind of external thing called a meaning of life, I'm not going to tell you, there's not an answer to that. But I can tell you about what a meaningful life is. there's a lot of meaning in it. And the meaning that we have, what is it that's meaningful to you? And I think most people would immediately answer, the people I love. You know, I mean, my family, my friends, my teachers, and also the work that I do. We're gonna come to that also. So really, the work and the love. Now, Chuangzi, if you say, what's the meaning of life? He would go, pfft. Think of yourself as an ongoing expression of life. That's what you are. And don't get yourself tied into knots thinking about stuff like meaning. What do you have to justify your existence before? You're alive. Just live. You know? You're causing yourself all sorts of problems with the machinations going on up there. Let it go. Animals don't worry about that question. All right, so here's the thing. If you look at this modes of connection, these are the things that if you don't have a notion of an afterlife, and you want to think about what are the larger connections that are going to sort of transcend my one existence, survive me, these are the different modes. So the biological, for example, right? We are our children and our grandchildren, right? There's a lineage through our family, and we're connected back with our ancestors and forward with our children and grandchildren, right? So that is much greater than my one life. That's part of the connectedness. The second one would be creative, and that's what I mean by our work, our contribution, what we leave behind. It could be we helped with an organization that's going to survive us, right? Or we leave behind a work of art or a book or something, right? Our work. Then what I call general human relatedness, our effects on others, our students, our friends, the people that just are around us that we've had an impact on. Then nature itself. We take comfort in the fact that our lives and deaths are intimately connected up with the larger cycles of the life and death in the natural world. Zhuangzi himself writes, human beings return to the wellsprings of nature. And finally, what I'm calling here a sort of experience of oneness, the non-dual mystical experience, where if you have these moments when the boundaries between yourself and other things dissolve, and you feel that there's no separation anymore, the fear of loss goes away. You know, there's nothing to lose. There's no separate self in the first place. And he'll sometimes talk like that. So one of the points that I want to make about these thinkers is the Confucians emphasize the biological, the creative, and the human relatedness, the first three. Zhuangzi emphasizes the last two, nature and this experience of oneness. So all of the Confucian forms of connection are grounded in a narrative conception of temporality and selfhood. And then I'm going to throw in my last distinction here. They all depend on our ability to remember. Confucians acknowledge the fact that we are who we are because of whom we have loved, lived with, and learned from. One's life is irreducibly social. The connections that Zhuangzi emphasizes are grounded in these momentary and natural cycles, temporalities, and they depend on our ability to forget. The primary connections with nature itself. We are at our root, nature. So there's a lot of senses in which memory is very important for the Confucians. We can talk about that afterwards, since I'm going to close off my lecture in a moment. And Zhuangzi, of course, I've talked, is all about forgetting. I'll just read you a nice quote from Zhuangzi about forgetting. Forget things. Be a forgetter of self. The man who has forgotten self may be said to have entered heaven. Fish forget themselves in rivers and lakes. People forget themselves in the arts of the way. So I want to just give you my conclusion. And forgive me if this time I'm kind of going to read it just because I want to get this right. I've been thinking about it a lot, so I'm just going to read this. Because now I ask the big question. This is, to me, when I'm done thinking about these thinkers, well, which way should we live? The way of remembering or the way of forgetting? Who should speak to us more, the Confucians or the Taoists? Or does one of them speak to you more than the other? For me, I love them both. And they both speak to me. So one of my big questions is, how do the two work together? Can they? So here's what I've come up with. Both the Confucians and the Taoists and Zhuangzi remind us of important truths. Confucians show us that it is important to step back and see the course of our lives over time, the narrative. At the same time, Zhuangzi remind us, we realize ourselves to the fullest when we're so absorbed in an activity that self and time disappear. We must live in partial remembering and partial forgetting, for each must be tempered by the other. We must both create ourselves over the course of our lives and forget ourselves in the greatest moments of our lives. And if we do the former well, we make the latter more likely. If there is no forgetting, we are bound. We are prisoners of our past rather than creative appropriators of it. Unless we can forget, we are debilitated by loss rather than reintegrated into life. The grasp of memory can lead to ossification and suffocation as we become frozen into what we have been rather than open to what we might be. Yet, if there is no remembering, we lose the goods that a vision which can embrace longer spans of time makes available to us. Narrative is what produces the life of each one of us and is thus necessary in creating and living a good life. Only through narrative can a self be cultivated. Memory helps us to sustain a relationship with the living and the dead, which does justice to how much they meant and continue to mean to us. So living well requires that we live the continuous tension and paradox of remembering and forgetting, holding on and letting go, cultivating the self and forgetting the self. The Confucian way is one of making connections through this expansion of self, and Zhuangzi's way is making connections through forgetting the self. We're left with two different visions. So Zhuangzi's, I think, is a way of transcending the suffering that for many of us seems to inevitably accompany the death of others and the prospect of our own deaths. The Confucian way is one that finds meaning within the experience of suffering and death. In his poem, Ash Wednesday, T.S. Eliot writes, "Teach us to care and not to care." This is another way to see this Confucian-Taoist divide. The Confucians teach us to care. Take things seriously. Zhuangzi teaches us to take things really lightly. So Eliot's words convey the importance of incorporating both perspectives into our lives. My hope is that by seeing how these important Chinese thinkers understood, approached, and learned from death, we understand better what they thought about life and why they lived as they did. And hopefully their words can reach across a great cultural and historical distance to help us live better lives and die better deaths. So that is what I have here. I'd love to hear your questions, and I want to start by asking you one, because I started thinking a lot about this before I came here today, which is, how does this connect up with your life, and particularly your practice here? And the reason I'm interested in that question is, sitting, we're on this cushion, seems very much to have a form of momentary temporality. I mean, it's just each moment as it comes. We shouldn't be thinking of, okay, this week. Nobody ever experiences a week or a month, right? You only experience a moment. A week is a creation of the mind. A month is a creation of the mind. How was your month? You have to think about it. So here on the cushion, it's a momentary temporality. I realize this when I sit with my glasses off, and I realize, like, I have to know when the time is to ring the bell. How do you know when the time is? I mean, time doesn't work the same way. If you're sitting for all, you don't know what half an hour feels. I don't know anyway. So is it a momentary thing? But at the same time, Buddhism talks about cultivation all the time, right? We talk about the bodhisattva path. We talk about cultivating the perfections and the virtues, and that takes time. We even can talk about the fact that our practice develops and gets better over time. So it seems like we all have within this practice a momentary temporality and a narrative temporality that we're working. And I'm very interested in how they either work with each other or could be in tension with each other and how you experience that. So, but any question is open. I just launched that one out to to see what you think.
Well, I just have some comments or reflections. The ending about sort of doing both or remembering and forgetting, that this whole thing makes me think of what I think is a Native American concept of walking in two worlds. And, you know, in Buddhism, we do talk about the conditioned and the unconditioned. And I do think the practice and the teachings are particularly about the unconditioned, and I'm sometimes frustrated because, you know, what I learned from Buddhism doesn't tell me anything how to live my life in the practical world about, you know, should I develop my talents? You know, should I, what kind of job should I have? And that sort of thing. It just is this, you know, the effacement of the self through practice and opening up to the present moment, which is very satisfying. And then sort of indirectly, you do function differently in the world. You don't get as hung up on certain things, or you're not as caught in clinging or aversion and so forth. Operate more skillfully. But I think this was really interesting and enjoyable, but it just fit for me with this idea. Both are important to walk in two worlds.
Well, thank you. That's a really good metaphor to use. I mean, they use the conventional and ultimate, or all these distinctions. And one of the things that I was thinking about when I talked about that we cultivate ourselves over time and then forget ourselves in the greatest moment of our lives, I think about, say, you know, if I look at the athlete or the musician, right? I mean, if you're completely absorbed, you know, at that moment when you're in the zone and it's effortless and time sort of, you know, just flies and you're not even aware of the passage of time, the person who's in that spot spent years and years training themselves and developing themselves so they can get to that point. That was a developmental narrative that allowed for that momentary flow state experience. So what I'm thinking of when you're talking about developing your talents is that in terms of sitting, I think it has this really interesting reciprocal relationship. So I'm more in the musical side than the athletic, so I'll just talk about that. In terms of music, I think, like, you know, sitting here really helps me when I'm in those moments, you know, if I'm performing, for example, to be able to let go of all the stuff about, you know, will this be successful and what's going to happen tonight, and just play, right? But then even in the developmental part, when I'm practicing scales or something, I can get past the kind of, you know, oh man, I have to sit here and do this, to just, wait, even that chatter I don't need. It's just fingers on the fretboard. And can I just be completely and fully mindful here? So even in the process of cultivation, mindfulness can come in. In other words, I mean, I hope I could put this right, the narrative trajectory of development can help you become more and more mindful as your practice deepens. But the path along the way itself can be infused and supported by mindfulness. So I think both of them can reinforce each other, if that makes sense. Right. I mean, Chuang Tzu doesn't quite ever acknowledge that, because he talks about all these really skillful people. Like he's got a wood carver who's really skillful, and he's got all these people who are really good, a butcher and all these things. And he talks about their state when they're in it, you know, how they're effortless and how it's, you know, that effortless action I talked about. He doesn't talk about how they got there though. And that's got to have been a narrative development. So I think you're right. I think over time, learning to let go of all that stuff that we create in our minds is a practice. We call it a practice. And it does take time.
The kind of Buddhist idea that's running through my mind is that quote about my view is as vast as the sky, but my attention to my actions and the intentions behind my actions is as fine as a grain of barley flour. So it does hold both these worlds, and I feel like it does address how we are in the world. I mean, I don't think the Buddha would say cultivating talents, but he would say cultivating your heart. Mm. You know, and what does that mean? Because I think cultivating talent, I mean, that just has weight to me, like, which I don't know. But cultivating the heart, I feel like I can trust in that and I can rest in that. And that tells me how I relate to you. That tells me how I relate to my work, in my view. So I'm a little confused by your perception. It doesn't tell you how to be in the world.
I appreciate that. I think, and not just cultivating the heart. I think a lot of times there's the notion of cultivating perfections or cultivating virtues. I mean, that there is that language of development, and stages on the path as Bodhisattva way. I like the first thing you said though, because a lot of my metaphors have been temporal. I think a lot about time, but yours was spatial, right? The vastness and the. I think a lot of times whenever we talk about things that are ultimate, like an abstract like this, really what we're doing largely is searching for the right metaphors. And I think that there's really helpful, which metaphors are helpful to you? And for me, just this understanding of the way that remembering and forgetting and narrative and momentariness work together. And there are tensions. There can be tensions. I mean, for example, one of the things that I've struggled with, and I know that there's an interesting Buddhist perspective on it, but it's still not easy for me, is to think that if our focus is on the present moment, when we're sitting on this cushion, what about the stuff that has to do with planning and the future and all of that? Well, then you say, yes, but when you're planning, you're still doing it in the present moment, right? So you could still be mindful in a present moment way of planning. Yes, but then my mind keeps going out of the present moment into the future, and I'm launching myself out. And I feel this as an academic, too. It's, to me, sitting, the beautiful thing about sitting, like I said, is I'm not in my head. And I feel that way about yoga, which is a really important practice to me. But can I be mindful when I'm writing an academic paper? Because that is in my head. That is the verbiage, the concepts, the abstract thinking. It's, to me, that's one of the greatest challenges of mindfulness for me is that. How to be mindful of the thinking and the activity itself to keep that non-verbal awareness of, in the midst of all the verbal activity.
I'm really intrigued about the tension part of all this, the need for it. In fact, it's almost as if the tension is the light. We couldn't recognize being in the flow and in the moment if we didn't have an experience of being out of it. And there's a need for the things that we see as distractions or detractions from the way we want to be, that they have a useful purpose. And I see that repeated over and over and over and over again in nature and all that is. So I'm looking for something to give me a little bit of guidance as to not necessarily the path to take, but what is the right path, but maybe my relationship with that tension, that's in the middle of that.
I really like the way you put that, because I really think ultimately it's about living the tensions always. I mean, when I study different religious traditions, and ultimately when students are studying any tradition, they're going to say, there's this tension running straight through the religion. It seems like this contradiction, How can we be created in the image of God and yet be sinful? And whatever your religion is, there's going to be that. And in the end, to me, that's one of the most productive things you can ask about any tradition or any practice is, what are the tensions, and they're creative tensions. I mean, that's how I see them. It's impossible, I think, ultimately to reconcile all the complex things that we are. So can we learn to live productively in the tension? And that, to me, that's one of the things I was trying to do. How the remembering and the forgetting, how the holding on and the letting go temper each other. Because if each were without the other, it would turn into ultimately a deformation. There are really negative ways to cling and to hold on. And yet if you never have that connection, right, with others, if you say, I'm going to just be detached in the fullest way, you miss so much of life. That's why I don't like the word detachment. Non-attachment is better, I think, for me, or non-grasping or non-clinging. And the same thing, forgetting can be very healthy. I mean, to be able to let go. But there's also a part of it where it makes a meaningful relationship impossible. So that's the creative tension.
I was just wondering if Buddhism in itself may have kind of that aspect of the middle way, you know, the kind of resolving or like proposing this possibility that there is this middle way between the two poles, between the self and the non-self. And a couple of quotes came to mind. I'm not sure exactly if this is the real quote by Dogen, you know, where he says, to remember the self is to forget the self.
Ah.
The self is to be connected with all beings. And so that there's that kind of like back and forth dynamic process of being here and there at any given moment. And also the other thing that came up, you know, like this quote from the third Zen patriarch where it says at the end of those famous verses on the faith mind, where it talks about the non-dual is one with the trusting mind. And so this whole aspect of trusting, you know, that kind of maybe going back into this child of innocence, like, and the faith, you know, like trusting the process. So that sometimes, you know, that very sense, even to be attached to the idea of enlightenment is to go astray, and at a certain time I'm going to be preoccupied with daily worries and chores and stuff, but other times, well, I'd better let go, and there's where the moment is itself.
That's a really wonderful sentiment. I mean, I think to me sometimes that's also what, you know, can be meant by skillful means, right? To know what is needed in which context, that there are times to do the one and a time to do the other. And the middle path also is a useful way to think about avoiding the extremes of two poles. And I actually, I see we're a little bit past our time. So I just want to mention, you know, as I was thinking at the end about how the two can support each other, you know, in our lives as we try to walk the middle path and navigate the tensions, is I think that we can bring this momentary awareness that we cultivate, the present moment focus on the cushion, into the experience of our lives to help us navigate the ups and downs and obstacles and challenges of the path as we develop ourselves. It helps us to better cultivate virtues. It helps us get rid of vices and overcome obstacles. Mindfulness, which isn't about intentionally changing things, does end up changing us over time if we don't force. But then on the other hand, seeing our practice of sitting located in the larger trajectory of our lives, seeing where we are on the path and even how that fits into the larger history of the tradition, can give us a sense of connection. I think connection with those around us, connection with those who went before us, and can help us see the relationship of the practice to other aspects of our lives. So I hope that it's, I guess we can say to ourselves, may it be a productive tension for all of us. Trish, it's past 8:30. Can we keep going, or do you want the social time? Or?
Yeah, there's tea and treats. So why don't we just have like a couple of minutes or so just together in class, and then I just have a couple of announcements. So
we have two more. Can we take two more questions?
Yeah, more. Yeah,
okay, so go ahead, and we'll go.
Well, it just occurred to me that we are studying the words of the person that said, there is no self. And that part of our insight is coming from the fact that he did write something.
Right. This is really a great...
It just hit me. Oh my God.
He was not unaware of the tension himself. In fact, the Tao Te Ching has this famous passage, Jir Jir Bu Yen, Yen Jir Bu Jir, which is those who speak do not know, and those who know do not speak, right? At which point people said, so what are you writing a book for? I mean, right? If you're the one, who knows. So that leads to the question of why is his language so slippery, so crazy? So it's so that you don't hold on to it. For him, language is more important for what it does than for what it says. He's not trying to give you a truth to put in your mind. He's trying to change you with the way he's using words skillfully. At one point he writes, he says, the fish trap exists to get the fish. He says, the words, he says, exists for the meaning. When I've got that, let's get rid of words. And then his last line in that was, where can I find a person who has forgotten words so I can have a word with him? Right? If you know how to use it skillfully, you don't get stuck in it. It's the same thing about a self. You know, conventionally in the world, we need one to get along. But, you know, sometimes it's sort of, we can think of it as a protean self, a changing one, not to get stuck in it.
I'll share with you my personal life. I was born in a country that adopted these three different concepts, Buddhism, Confucianism, and Taoism.
Ah.
And beyond the struggle that is in the thing that we're discussing. Myself, I chose the path of Vipassana by Master Mahasi, not much for the glory of Ajahn, but Taiwan. We talk a lot about rebirth and 33 stages of heaven to reach to. But the end goal is to become a Buddha. Okay, so our practice of Vipassana is very different than what you do here, according to Mahasi tradition. To answer some questions, to realize the practice of how we're living this life. In my family, we chose to go to the higher education we can, like PhD, whatever we choose to do, in order to earn a living, to give back to society according to Confucius' teaching, like I just read to you earlier. And then the second part to call it spiritual intelligence that helped us to become a better person and eventually
thank you. And last thing, and then we'll go over the thing. You made me think of this. Can I ask where you're from?
Vietnam.
Okay, so...
not under communism.
Right. Here's one thing that I love about studying the traditions of East Asia and Southeast Asia. One of the things that students quickly find out is that the whole notion of religious affiliation is different there. In the United States, generally, people are in one tradition, and that's it. And the idea that I can be two or three different things, it's like, well, how can you do that? You have to pick one. But in most of East Asia, throughout history, people have had no problem saying, I find truth in all of these. There's something very powerful to learn from the Confucians, the Taoists, and the Buddhists. And why should I have to choose one at the expense of the other? My life involves family and social relationships. My life also involves being a part of the natural world, and it also involves this practice that I have. And so I think the harmonious integration, working towards, again, and there will be tensions, but you can productively work through those. I think my whole thing in life has been, I've never been an either or person. I've always been a both and. And I think my life is always an ongoing attempt at harmonizing these various strands in my life. And I think we all are inheritors of multiple strands. So we're always working to weave a more beautiful and harmonious tapestry out of them, ultimately. So, well, thank you, everyone, very much. This has been a lot of fun. So thank you. I appreciate it.
Thank you for listening. To learn how you can support the teachers and Dharma Seed, please visit dharmaseed.org/donate.